Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Miller sets, fires, swing and a miss, struck him out on a slider. The pitch, swing and a miss, got him with a slider. So Miller strikes out Bryant. Swing and a miss, chased the slider in the other batter's box. Andrew Miller strikes out the side. In the pitch, Coco Chris Lewis swings, lines one to right. Coming on, playing it on the bounce is Soler. It's a base hit. Coming home to score is Martinez. Throw to third by Soler, and Rajay Davis is thrown out at third. But the Indians have a 1-0 lead on the pinch hit. RBI single to right by Coco Chris. Allen with that deep breath comes set. Checks both runners. Now the 2-2. Swing and a miss! Ball game! He got him with a high heater! And the Indians have beaten the Chicago Cubs. 1-0. In a brilliant ball game here at Wrigley Field. Swung on, hit high and deep to right. Hayward's back on the track, looking up, it is gone, and we've got a tie game. Carlos Santana with his first World Series hit. Swung on a little dribbler, third base side. Charging Bryant, bare hand grab, throw on the run. It's not in time! Here comes the runner from third, Chisenhall to score. Ball got away from Rizzo at first. On his way to third is Naquin. And the Indians have a 2-1 lead. On a swinging bunt single, halfway down the third baseline by Corey Kluber. Swung on, line shot, that'll be a base hit into center. Kipnis is going to be able to score from second. Lindor has delivered an RBI single to center, and it's 3-1 Indians. Swing and a miss. He went back in there and he got him on the curveball. Kluber with his third strikeout gets Ben Zobrist. Swung on, pounded, deep right field. It's got a chance. Gone! There's a game breaker. Jason Kipnis with a 3-run blast to right. And it's 7-1 Indians. Oh, what a night for the Chicago Kid. A swing and a grounder back to the mound. Otero gloves, throws to first. Ball game. And the Indians are 1-1 away from a World Series championship.
Everybody on their feet. The Cubs a strike away. Chapman, the 0-2 pitch, and a swing and a foul tip held by Contreras. And the World Series is headed back to Cleveland for Game 6.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed. Good Monday afternoon to you. Thank you for joining us 10 minutes after 3 right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. What a weekend that was. We have so much to get into. We saved all of the football conversation and highlights for a little bit later in the show because obviously we're getting down to the nitty-gritty. The baseball world championship will be decided within 2 games. And I say within 2 games, not in 2 games, because it could be 1 and it could be 2. And I got to tell you, after last night, I could not be happier with the way things are turning out. I will explain that a little bit more as we continue, but I could not be happier with the fact that there's going to be baseball tomorrow night, and it's going to be out there in Cleveland, and the Indians are going to have the chance to pop champagne corks in their city, as opposed to the last championship won by that city, which was just 4 months ago. In June, when the fans had to celebrate from 2,500 miles away as the Cavaliers won in Game 7 out in Oakland, California. Now the Indians have a chance to do something in their own building and just set that city. And I mean this figuratively, not literally, as far too many cities in the past have done. Detroit's been part of that. But they have a chance to set that city on fire with their spirit, of course, is what I mean. So, that's where we are baseball-wise. A lot of football stuff to talk about today. We want you to be involved with it. Dennis Maniloff will be involved with it. We're going to talk to him coming up at about 3:35 from Cleveland, where he'll talk about the World Series and also about yesterday's NFL action. The Browns on their way to my predicted 0-16. They had a chance yesterday against probably the only team that they had a chance or have a chance against the New York Jets, and they blew a 20-7 lead in losing 31-28. So just miserable, and it will continue to get more miserable with Dallas, Baltimore, Pittsburgh, and the Giants the next four. Then Cincinnati, Buffalo. Buffalo's a question mark. San Diego and Pittsburgh. I think they lose literally eight more in a row. 2016, this is the way I see it. Somebody tweeted this to me, Kushlin, and I thought it was outstanding during game number two, I think it was. Or might have been after game, well, no, I'm sorry, not game number two. Game number four in the series when the Indians took a 3-1 lead. Game number two in Wrigley is what I'm trying to say, as they just played three straight Friday, Saturday, and Sunday out there. Somebody tweeted to me the year 2016, which we are in right now, and it makes perfect sense. Two world championships for Cleveland teams, 0-16 for the Cleveland Browns. That's what 2016 stands for. I mean, really. And you know what? They'll take that. I promise you, Indians, Browns, Cavaliers fans will all accept the humility and the humiliation of 0-16 for the football team if it means two championships in one calendar year for the other two teams.
I know I, as a Cleveland fan, have already made that trade-off in my own head.
Well, you know, the truth is, I mean, they don't have to have any championships, and what choice do we have but to sit here and watch the misery of 0-16 anyway? I mean, this is just, that's how bad they are. It's the worst franchise. I've said it before, and I'll continue to say it until it ceases to be true. It's the worst franchise in all team sports in North America. And I will say worse than any team in the NBA, including the Sixers, anybody in hockey that I'm not really even aware of how bad they run. There's nobody run as bad as that franchise. So it is what it is. You kind of shake all of that off. And the way I phrased it when somebody brought that up, I said, you know what? If you fill your brain with the memories of two parades in 4 months, then your brain has no room to remember 0-16, zero wins in 2016. That's it. That's, you know, our brains can only handle so much anyway. Speaking of humility and humiliation, the Lions, of course, did themselves nor their fans any good whatsoever with a questionable loss, a loss that, quite frankly, you know, nobody should accept. Not that you would ever accept losing, but I'm sorry. After the way we saw Brock Osweiler and the Texans play 1 week earlier on Monday night, it's really an embarrassing loss for a team that had won three in a row, that was playing the best football it has played all year long, talking about the Lions. For them to drop that game to that team, for them to look, I don't even know, lethargic and right, lackadaisical isn't right, I don't know what it is, but the Texans are not a good football team. They are 5-3 now, and yes, they are undefeated at home, and you factor that in. But the way the Lions lost that game to that team, I just felt like that should have been a win for a team that was on a roll. It's a step backwards for the Lions to take nothing away from, you know, some individual players, but as a franchise, it's a step backward. Brock Osweiler, and what did we say going into that game, by the way, excuse me, what did we say going into that game on this program? We said both teams are probably looking at this in very, very similar ways, but from opposite sides of the spectrum. And that is, you know what? The Texans are thinking to themselves, man, we can't seem to get any passing game going at all. We can't seem to move the football. We can't do anything, really effectively. Good thing we got Detroit coming up, because their defense, especially in the second half, is a problem. But if you're the Lions defense, you're going into that game going, man, we just can't seem to stop anybody. We just can't seem to get anything done with any consistency. But you know what? Good thing we got Osweiler and the horrific Texans passing game coming in. Now's the time for us to get well. Only one of those two sides could be right, and we saw which side it was. It was Houston. Osweiler bounces back, goes 20-29 for a 186. Not great. One touchdown, one pick, a passer rating of 83.4. But it was good enough, because Matthew Stafford did not have one of his best outings. In what has been characterized by many, myself included, as a MVP-like first half of the season through seven games, and not that he's going to win the MVP, but an MVP-like first half. He comes out with a 27-41 performance, 240 yards, a touch, no picks, but a quarterback rating of only 89.5, well below his season average of about 106 going into that game, his season quarterback rating. So, and in QBR, Brock Osweiler was much higher, actually. He had a 57.8 QBR, and Matthew Stafford a 44 QBR. So, not that it all comes down to, those two guys. But a disappointing loss for the Lions, who really should have finished the first half of the season, as it will, you know, not that it's the bye yet. The bye will be after Minnesota this week, but 8 games have been played. They should have finished this thing at 5-3, and instead it's 500 at 4-4. And not a good loss.
And of all the things you said there, Bob, the word that comes back into my head as correct is step backward. I mean, this is a Texans team that despite the fact they're 5-3 and undefeated at home, as you pointed out, they're not that great. They don't have the services of one J.J. Watt right now, Mr. Difference Maker on D himself. And they just didn't seem to have it. I'm not sure which term you were debating, lethargic, whatever, what term to use, and neither was really correct. Because what's amazing is...
uninspired, maybe.
There you go. I like that one, because at the end of the day, this is one of the first time this season that the Lions' defense didn't falter completely in the second half. Lions actually outscored the Texans 10-6 in the second half of this game. So that wasn't the problem for once, and yet they still end up losing a game, albeit on the road, that on paper going in, they totally should have won that one.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. That's what makes it a very, very, you know, and this league is very tough.
Yeah.
It's very hard to figure out sometimes, to be quite frank. You know,
you do have the any given Sunday kind of factor that's always there.
Yeah, you do. You know, and you lose games you should win, and then sometimes you're going to win games you should lose. But guess what? The championship teams, the teams that end up making the playoffs, and the teams that end up making some noise in the playoffs, those are the teams that find a way to win the games you really shouldn't win, and they avoid the losses to the teams that they shouldn't lose to. And that's the difference.
Yeah.
You know, and this is, I guess it's a baby step process. Nobody is trying to say that the Lions are supposed to be the, you know, the Cowboys who are just rolling right now after their overtime win last night, or the Patriots or anybody else. But if you want to take steps, these are steps. Win games like this one.
Yep.
You really cannot afford to lose a game like that. So you've got the Lions dropping one to the Texans, and obviously, as we pointed out, the Browns fall to 0-8 with a 20-7 lead, absolutely wasted. They could not be stopped. Josh McCown looked so good in the first half against the Jets, and they could not string any kind of offensive rhythm together in the second half, as they are outscored in the second half big time. Again, final 31-28. And I'll say this about the Cleveland Browns. They have some guys who don't mail it in. They don't quit, and I don't want to say that anybody that is in a uniform is tanking this season whatsoever. I believe that. I believe they're doing their best. But I just find the lack of ability for that front office and for the upper management staff, including the general manager, including Sashi Brown, I find their inability to mix some true veteran leadership in with all of these young guys, this youngest roster in the National Football League, with 27 out of the 53-man roster, I believe it was just over half, either rookies or in their first first year after the rookie season with 1 year of experience, to mix in veterans to help them at least have the pride enough to finish games like that one against the New York Jets. I'm not putting it on the players. And I'm not really even putting it on head coach Hugh Jackson. I'm putting it on specifically upper management. I know they don't necessarily want to win a ton right now. I know there's, you know, there are allegations that they are tanking, not the players, but that the front office doesn't really, really care. The front office personnel doesn't really care how poorly they play, because they've got tremendous draft picks coming, high draft picks. They want to get the number one overall pick. They could have, and they should have done something to at least bring enough veteran leadership or veteran pride, if you will, to this organization or to that organization to help them get by and not be completely embarrassed on a weekly basis. That loss to the New York Jets yesterday, a Jets team, by the way, that is awful, that is in its own state of transition.
Yep.
The whole Ryan Fitzpatrick to Geno Smith, now back to Fitzpatrick because of the injury story. That's a mess of a franchise in its own right. And for them to blow a 20-7 lead against that team, again, it might be their only chance to win, and I really hang a lot of that on the front office. So just a very, very disappointing thing to see there, but not totally unexpected. And I do not blame Hugh Jackson at all.
Had a chances, didn't finish it. It's kind of been the story of our season, though. Again, I take responsibility for that. I mean, somehow, some way, we got to find a way in the second half to finish games when we have an opportunity. Like I told them, this is us. It has nothing to do with anybody else. We got to play better, finish. Get better. It's hard, but we don't stay after it. You know, it's halfway through the season. We're 0-8, and we own the record, and we got to play better. Just that simple.
Yeah, it is just that simple. They do just have to play better. I understand that, but I'll tell you what. Again, you know, this is hard for Hugh Jackson to get that group of guys playing better. Yeah. Musical chairs with quarterbacks. Six different quarterbacks have started now. They're back to Josh McCown, who was the second, of course, who got injured after Robert Griffin, who was the first, got injured, and on we go. And it's just really a very frustrating thing. My frustration is more, as you can imagine, for the fans. Did you see the empty seats on TV?
I did notice that.
I mean, my God. I mean, it was. I know it's Halloween and all, and so it was great to see all the orange. But, you know, not really. Not really. You don't. You just don't want to have to see that sort of thing. It's just really, really disappointing for me to see those fans have to have really nothing to cheer for. Now, I know that you say, well, they do have something to cheer for. Their team's in the World Series. Well, yeah, I get it, but... I was listening to, was it Golic? It might have been Golic, but it wasn't this morning. It might have been on Friday. Talking about how, you know, because he's a native Clevelander, as Cushlin is and as I am. He talked about how it's a football town. As great as the Cavs championship is, as great as the Indians being in the World Series, one win away from a championship might be for the fans there, it's a football town, and they will suffer and endure the pain of the Browns losing, and it will have more of an impact on them sometimes than the on some people than winning championships in the other cities would. And those fans just have, you know, there's a reason why the comedian who did the Factory of Sadness video just, you know, that went viral. Because it is just such a factory of sadness. That building just produces more and more tears and misery each and every week than any fan base should have to endure.
And then on top of all that, Bob, and I can't wait to hear, by the way, Dennis Manilov's answer to this one. You know, we're talking about the things like veteran leadership and that this is the worst run franchise in sports and all that stuff. I can't wait to hear Dennis Manilov's answer to, did the Browns just get hoodwinked by good old Belichick again? Did you hear about this one? The trade they made
the
today.
Trade.
A guy who's a free agent, he said the right things apparently after he gets traded to the Browns, but I can't imagine he's going to be here past eight games. Why would you resign? And they give up, a compensatory third-round pick. Please note, those haven't even been distributed yet, but the Browns are confident they're going to get one somehow.
Yeah, well, you know, nobody's going to sign here long term unless they're federally sentenced by a judge. There in Cleveland. Nobody's
in lieu of
that.
Jail time, you get to play the Factory of Sadness.
Yeah,
enjoy.
I mean,
maybe you'll think twice next time.
Yeah, I mean, it's honest to God. Nobody's going to do that. So, yeah, probably did. They probably did just get hoodwinked again out of some picks by Bill Belichick. Bill, you know what I mean? Anytime Bill Belichick calls, I would just imagine you say, I see that caller ad. I recognize that number. Don't take the call. That's just the way that it goes. All right, college game. We want to get a lot of our Monday afternoon quarterback stuff out of the way here because we're going to talk baseball at 3:35 with Manilov in the World Series. Let's start with Ohio State. Ohio State, 24-20 winners over Northwestern. Another very lackluster performance from Urban Meyer's club that is kind of suffering through now what has been a month-long mid-season swoon. And it goes back to... You know, their last dominating win was the 58-0 win over hapless Rutgers at the first of the month on October 1st. Indiana, 1 week later, at the Horseshoe, gave them far more than they wanted, 38-17. Ohio State did not look very impressive in the passing game in that game, if you recall. Then 1 week later, it was the nighttime, the prime time at Camp Randall in Wisconsin, and it took overtime to beat the Badgers 30-23. 1 week later, another prime timer out at Happy Valley when the whiteout for Penn State may have helped the Nittany Lions to the actual victory over Urban's club, 24-21. Now you think, well, all right, that's enough of a wake-up call. They're going to come back clicking on all cylinders at home again at the Horseshoe against Northwestern. And it's a 24-20 game, and people are once again wondering, whatever happened to the vaunted Buckeye passing game?
Mm-hmm.
JT Barrett is considered to be, by almost everybody, the greatest quarterback in Ohio State history. If you go, I mean, you know, as far as passing quarterbacks go, you got to go back into the 50s and look at Janowitz and other people like that. But as far as quarterbacks go, you know, there's Braxton Miller and we've gone through the list of potential guys that have been great passers for Ohio State. He's widely considered. He holds all the records. And they can't seem to throw the ball effectively enough to really put numbers on people. And it's a very, you know, kind of methodical isn't the right word. That would indicate too much control over the situation. Just very lackluster. I'll go back to that one again.
Yeah.
Win over Northwestern. There's 4 weeks left of the regular season. Two of them are incredible challenges. One of them is this weekend against Nebraska at home. Nebraska undefeated no more after an incredibly hard-fought loss to Wisconsin, those same Badgers. But Nebraska is very good. Michigan, we know, is rolling in number two in the country. Those will be sandwiched around Maryland and Michigan State on the road. But there's 4 games left for them to get right, or they're going to find themselves on the outside looking in when the playoffs come around. Obviously, depending on whether or not they win the Big Ten at the East and go and win the Big Ten championship game. But the way they're playing, I don't know that you can just write that in any longer, even in pencil, and say, yeah, things are still just fine in Buckeye Land.
Yeah, no doubt about that. No doubt about that, Bob. And it starts with this game on Saturday against Nebraska. This is now a battle of top 10 teams because despite the loss, I guess the AP pollster guys decided it was a tough enough loss that we're only going to drop you from 7 to 9. So this remains a battle of top 10 teams. And, you know, almost the best thing you could say about this Northwestern game, honestly, was at least it was a win. I mean, it's not just 24-20. This game was tied 17-all going into the fourth quarter. And there truly is not a ton of positive to say for the Buckeyes on this one, except, well, at least it's still a W.
Yeah, that's it. That's really all you can say. You're exactly right about that. And you know, you look at the rankings, Ohio State stays where they were at 6 with that victory. And part of the reason I think they didn't get dropped a little bit because of that very scattershot performance against the Wildcats is if you look at the rest of the top 25 and you look at the results, it wasn't a solid week. It was not a spectacular
week. Right.
Almost everybody in the top 5, top 6, 7, 8, 9 teams had very, very close games, some of them against very, very mediocre clubs. And that transitions us over, of course, to Michigan. And, you know, the revenge game against Michigan State. We had guests on from both Michigan State and Michigan last week, and both of them talked about how this thing could get out of hand. The Michigan offense, the way it looks, and their defense, the way they look, they could really embarrass Michigan State in this one, and we talked about whether or not we think that's going to happen. The spread, if memory serves, the spread was 25.
Yep.
Vegas had Michigan minus 25. And I remember reading a couple of people on Twitter and saying, I am grabbing that action. 25 is a ton of points for a rivalry game on the road. They're at East Lansing in a rivalry game. And sure enough, it was every bit the rivalry game that you might have expected.
Yep.
32-23, a much narrower margin of victory than the Wolverines would have liked. And my thought when I saw that is that, geez, you know, Michigan is still very, very questionable as a top two team. Because if I look at that list of vanquished opponents, Hawaii, UCF, Colorado, Penn State was a nice win, 49-10, especially after we saw what Penn State did to Ohio State. Wisconsin, that's another nice win, 14-7. Rutgers, Illinois, and now Michigan State. They haven't had really a big test other than Wisconsin. And Michigan State, as a rivalry game, that's a bit of a test. And they didn't exactly blow either one of those teams out, a 9-point win against one, a 7-point win against the other. And I thought, I wonder if that might make them slip a little bit. But then I continue on and I look at the rest of the top 10. Clemson, sitting at number 3, squeaked out a 37-34 win against Florida State. Now that it was at Tallahassee, 12th ranked Florida State was at Tallahassee, but it's only a field goal win. And remember, this is still a Clemson team that 2 weeks ago was a missed, 36-yard field goal at the gun away from being upset by unranked North Carolina State. So Clemson isn't exactly making a case to climb the charts. Washington against number 17 Utah, big battle out there in the Pac-12, only a 7-point win, 31-24. The Huskies stay undefeated. So, but again, not anything that would say climb.
Right.
Louisville, 32-25 against 2-6 now Virginia.
And Virginia's been awful for so many years.
Yeah.
Trust me on that one.
And Virginia, I mean, it took a huge fourth quarter for Louisville. They outscored them by 10 to win that game. They were trailing going into the fourth quarter against Virginia. Nebraska, as I mentioned, number 7, lost to number 11 Wisconsin. So a real tough matchup there, 23-17. Baylor loses its first game of the year to Texas, so they're 6-1 effectively out of the playoff hunt, as far as I'm concerned, because when it comes to one-loss teams, Baylor is not going to get the nod over anybody.
Yep.
And then number 10, West Virginia. They suffer their first loss as well, as Oklahoma State beat the living daylights out of West Virginia 37-20 out in Stillwater.
And by the way, with those finals you just mentioned, Baylor and West Virginia going down combined with Oklahoma early in the year, I think it's totally safe to say at this point Big 12 is out.
Absolutely. And by the way, as long as we're talking about undefeated teams remaining undefeated no longer, or not remaining undefeated, Boise State as well lost to unranked Wyoming 30-28. So if you look at all of the, and Alabama, of course, had a bye. Look up and down the top 10. Michigan didn't do any worse, really, than anybody else that was a contender in the top 10. So that's why they should stay a solid number two behind the Crimson Tide in the rankings. But they do not look to me like they are playing at the level they need to be playing over the next four. We just talked about Ohio State's Final Four. You know, Michigan's got Maryland, Iowa, Indiana, and then, of course, the Buckeyes. Not a ton of tests, if you will, in those first three, other than, of course, when you get to Columbus on the 26th of November. But they need to be really, really fine-tuning and blowing teams out before they get ready for that game.
By the way, random side note, you mentioned Boise State also ended up going down. That means the only non-power school right now in the entire nation that's undefeated hails from the Mid-American Conference, Western Michigan.
How about that? Yep, there you go. And by the way, speaking of the Mid-American Conference, the Rockets, of course, lost on Thursday to OU, which was a terrible, terrible loss. Really, really unfortunate with the season they had.
Let's call it what it is. They have to win these next three to make that Western Michigan game mean something for the West title. Yep. If they lose any one of these other three, you can pretty much give it to Western.
And that starts, by the way, on Wednesday when they've got Akron in action, Wednesday night action. And then, of course, tomorrow, Bowling Green, they are back at it again against Northern Illinois on the road at Northern Illinois. So that's where we are for now as far as our Monday afternoon quarterback goes. So what we're going to do is take a time out now and then shift gears into baseball talk. What is going on in the World Series? Is there any reason for panicking or any reason for concern that it's now 3-2 and the series shifts back to Cleveland? For me, I am perfectly happy with where we are right now. We'll explain why, and we'll talk to Maniloff and get his thoughts as we continue right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Once again, it's the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
All right, Jim Cushman, I got to ask you, was that accidental that you chose this song, or was it intentional?
Little A, little column A, little column B.
What's column B? What made it intentional?
I don't know.
You have no idea what
no.
you did.
No, okay. I
was wondering if you even realized that it was Halloween, because most slash producers are playing all kinds of Halloween music. And then I thought, here comes Cushman with Running with the Devil. Maybe it is a little Halloween theme there. I wanted to know if it was an accident or if you knew it. And clearly, it was an accident. Nothing from column B. Nothing from column
B. Honestly, because baseball has continued from my Indian standpoint so long, I almost find it hard to believe that today is Halloween, to be honest with you.
It is crazy. It is Halloween, though, so happy Halloween. Hopefully all of your ghosts and goblins and ghouls and vampires are going to be safe tonight. Make sure they wear something reflective. They hate it on their costume. I did. We all did. But keep those kids safe. All right, let's shift gears, go from football to the World Series as we welcome our good friend from Cleveland. He writes for the Northeast Ohio Media Group, covers all Cleveland sports for the Cleveland Plain Dealer and Cleveland.com. And he is, of course, an author as well. His wonderful book is From A to Z, Andrews to Zastadil. And I'm talking, of course, about Dennis Maniloff back once again. D-Man, how are you, brother?
Hey, Bob, I'd like to congratulate the Cubs on being the first team in MLB history to win a World Series despite trailing 3-2.
All right, go ahead.
Are you kidding me, Bob?
Go ahead and take your tongue out of your cheek. Tell me. All right, go ahead.
Holy smokes. I mean, okay, the Cubs had their backs against the wall. They had to win the game. Right. Okay, I get it. It was the first World Series win, and it Wrigley, you know, okay, in forever. Yeah. But come on. I mean, I'm surprised they're even going to bother to play Game 6, if not Game 7. I mean, the way you were hearing it last night from specifically the national guys, of course, but holy simoleons. I mean, I know the Cubs are popular, but yikes.
Well,
I mean, I respect the national guy on the radio. I won't name him because I like him, and okay. I didn't have the exact quote. I got the paraphrase. He comes out. He's so excited. He says, I can't wait to see how the Cubs figure out Josh Tomlin. And then 30 seconds later, I love Game 7. And I'm thinking, okay, so I guess we might as well not even play Game 6 because it's automatically going to 7. And the way you heard it last night, the Cubs have won. So why did the Indians even bother?
I didn't hear the national radio thing you're talking about. I didn't hear the national radio thing you're talking about. I don't know which guy you're talking about. But I will talk about this from the TV side. Joe Buck has, in my estimation, just lost all credibility, with me anyway, when it comes to calling national broadcasts, especially championship broadcasts, because we have endured now for 5 games literally every hard-hit Cubs ball, even if it results in a ground-out or a fly-out, anything that is solid wood to ball, his voice goes up like 8 octaves as if he is just about to call something spectacular. Whereas an Indian drives one out of here or has a run scoring a single or something like that, it's about as monotone as it can be. And that one's in the right field, a base hit. And, Perez will, I'm just making up, Perez will score and it's 2-0 Cleveland. Whereas if there's a fly ball out, there's a drive to left. And, Guyer settles under it, 2 outs. He just gets so excited with every call. Dennis, I'm not saying they have to be 100% impartial if they don't want to be, but they can at least pretend. And Joe Buck, to me, has created enemies in the city of Cleveland and really in all of Ohio where there are Indians fans, whether it be here in Toledo or anywhere else. But he has created enemies everywhere because he is not even pretending to be objective.
Bob, thank you for talking about tone, okay? Because I sent a tweet out, and I don't usually do this. I don't go after people in the media because I'm one of the media, and I don't want to be one of those guys who sits there and says, oh, look at this guy. And Joe Buck's a very talented broadcaster, but you are exactly right. Tone is the key to everything. I tweeted out that in my 40 years of watching World Series television, I've never heard a guy root for a team to the extent that Buck has rooted for the Cubs in this World Series. And the basis for that tweet was 99% tone and the way you called it, the inflection, the yelling. And I got 1,000 retweets or 1,000 favorites, 500 retweets, whatever that number is. One of my most retweeted tweets ever. I didn't expect that, but a lot of people jump in, and then I got, the snark, of course, which I expected from the Cubs people. Oh, first of all, don't you understand that Joe Buck used to be, a St. Louis guy and his dad was St. Louis and he's anti-Cubs? I don't care. I know that, but I don't care because I'm just judging him based on what I'm hearing in this series. And number two, and perhaps he's trying too hard to like the Cubs to appease Cubs fans after the years of being in St. Louis. But number two, the other thing was, well, give me examples, of his bias. It's hard to quantify on Twitter the tone bias, but that's what it is.
He starts hyperventilating every time there is a scoring opportunity for the Cubs, and he is just so, monotone whenever there is a scoring score by the Indians, and that it's all very obvious. Let me tell you how obvious it is, just for those who don't understand it. And not that this is an example of a call, but you know how they do at Cavaliers games at Quicken Loans Arena when the opposing team is shooting free throws, they'll put something up on the video board to make everybody boo to distract the shooter. Well, it was Joe Buck the other night against the Magic. Joe Buck's face went up there every time somebody was shooting, and the 20,000 strong boo. I mean, think about what you've done. This is a national broadcaster calling the World Series. That's how much enmity he has created among Indians fans with his blatantly obvious, patronizing of the Cubs.
First of all, I'm glad that Smoltz has been the heavy because Smoltz, I think, recognizes it as his analyst. He recognizes what's going on, and he's had to rein Buck in numerous times. I do think, though, granted that, Buck was doing games in Cleveland in games 1 and 2, but I really noticed it in 3, 4, and 5, and I think Buck, he'll never admit it because he's too much of a pro, but he got caught up in the whole Wrigley Field Chicago Cubs are back at Wrigley, you know, at World Series historical element. And he got swept up in all that fervor. And the stuff that I'm talking about, that I talked about at the top of this hit, which is this unbelievable amount of praise heaped on the Cubs for winning one game, you know, game five, to pull within 3-2 in the series. I think Buck got caught up in that whole wave of just emotion, and it's affected his broadcast, and it's disappointing.
Yeah, I think that might be something to that with the whole Wrigley thing. The other thing to me might just be that he wants a series. You know, he didn't really show it as much in games one and two. I noticed it, but if you didn't, that's okay. I'll excuse that, because maybe it wasn't as blatant, but because then it was the start of a series. Once he saw that the Indians were taking control of the series, he didn't want to just call the Cubs' first World Series in 45 years as Indians in five and have it just be done. I think he's excited that it's going six, and I think he'll be even more excited when he calls tomorrow night's game in anticipation of a game seven, because, well, you know, for selfish reasons, for him and for Fox and for, you know, for the entire nation that loves the Cubs story, he is cheerleading the Cubs story, whether it's at Wrigley or Progressive Field out there in Cleveland. He's cheerleading the Cubs story, and that to me is it's really unforgivable. Because, well, here, let me see if I can play this for you, Dennis, if I have it. Bob Costas was doing an interview with Dan Patrick on TV earlier today. I heard Bob Costas on TV today. And he was asked about why it is that the Indians are such an afterthought in this entire thing. And we know the story about the Cubs, but it's true. Even national talk show hosts like Patrick legendary figures like Costas have recognized the Indians are not getting their just due in this whole thing. Give this a quick listen.
I think three reasons. You take the Cubs out of the equation, maybe it isn't as much of a national story, but Cleveland becomes the story, not just because the Indians haven't won since 1948 and their loyal fan base has had its own share of disappointments, but it's a great story to link the Cavaliers in the spring with the Indians doubling down in the fall in a city that hadn't seen a major championship since 1964 in any sport, to get two of them in the space of a few months. And almost any other autumn, that would be the story. But now you get the Cubs. So, A, the Cubs have waited longer. B, I think this is part of it too. The Cubs have been a story all season long. This has been building all season long, because they're not a lightning in a bottle team. They're not a fluke. And I'm not saying that Cleveland is by any means, but this has been coming. They won the division a year ago, or they got in the playoffs a year ago and then beat the Cardinals and got to the LCS. They won 103 games. So there's been anticipation building, whereas Cleveland kind of came out of the shadows and into the postseason. And then the third factor is this. Again, through no fault of the current Indians team, these games are at Wrigley Field. And so all the demons and almost all the history, at least going back to 1914, only 6 years after their last championship, is in the building where these games are being played. Just like in 2004, all the history was at Fenway Park. So I think the venue makes a difference, too.
What do you think about all that, Dennis?
Those are solid points by Costas. Obviously you play the clip because the national media notices itself that the Cubs are being, you know, lavished with praise. So,
and the Indians are being ignored. That's the bit. I mean, it's okay to lavish them with praise, but they're just treating the Indians like they're just like the supporting actor here, as opposed to being one of the starring roles.
Bob, I did a video before I came on with you for Cleveland.com, and I said the headlines: the Indians are the annoying guests at the Cubs World Series party, and basically they're the guests that have kind of outlived their usefulness, or they're spilling drinks, or stealing shrimp. It's like this is all Cubs all the time, and they're an amazing look. And here's the thing too, Bob. I have friends in Chicago, very dear friends in Chicago. I went to school at Northwestern. I'm not dumping on Chicago fan per se. And I'm not necessarily dumping on the Chicago Cubs ball club. It's a tremendous team. It was favored almost 2-1 to win this World Series. But, man, alive. You watched that game last night, and every single pitch that's borderline, every single Cub is screaming about it, okay? And they're moaning and groaning and griping, and Lester is yelling and screaming on every single close pitch, and the fans are screaming. And, of course, the fans are entitled to do whatever they want. But this whole Chicago Cubs thing, I didn't think I could ever get sick of it, but now that I'm writing about the Indians against the Cubs, I'm actually sick of the whole Chicago Cubs hysteria.
Yeah, I am too, and that's a great, great point, Dennis. And now let's get back to baseball and talk about where we are. A lot of people are disappointed that the Indians didn't close it out in Chicago for obvious reasons, because you just want to get it done. You don't want to take any chances, and I get all of that. But if somebody would have asked you prior to game one if you would be happy coming back to Cleveland up 3-2 after five games, you'd sign on for that in a heartbeat. You'd say, I love that position. Here we are. We're in that position. But Chicago has at least a tiny modicum of momentum now because they did win game five. So it's 3-2, and it's Tomlin and it's Arrieta. We saw both of them once already in this series. What happens tomorrow night?
Well, first of all, you're exactly right. I mean, for the Indians to have split the first two at home, to come back here for six, up 3-2, you sign up for that. Absolutely. Realistically, could you have expected to sweep the Chicago Cubs in the road portion of the World Series? No. The fact that they got two out of three, it's huge for them. I mean, imagine how the outlook or the perspective would be nationally if it went, you know, win-loss-win at Wrigley instead of win-win-loss.
Right.
Then all of a sudden people will be probably saying maybe the Indians have a chance here. So the Indians are still in a good position. However, that being said, and you heard me just, you know, rail against all things Cubs love, the Cubs will be favored tomorrow night, as they should be, because of Arrieta. I mean, Arrieta is one of the most dominant pitchers in Major League Baseball over the last 2 years. They should be favored. Doesn't mean, though, that they're going to automatically win. That's my point. So the Cubs certainly don't feel bad about having Jake Arrieta on the mound in Game 6, who, by the way, won in Cleveland in Game 2. So I don't think the Cubs will be rattled by the surroundings. They certainly like their starting pitcher. They, you know, feel like they've lived to see another day. So they have a lot going for them. But at the same time, the Indians have no reason to feel bad about the way Game 5 went down. Game 5 was a classic, Bob France. It was a great game. That was a tremendous baseball game in so many ways. It had everything you could possibly want except, you know, home run derby, really. But the Indians played well.
Yeah, they really did. Let's get to the other guy, though. You didn't mention Josh Tomlin. Josh Tomlin has been lights out this postseason in much the same way that Corey Kluber has been lights out this postseason. And I don't feel as though there's much of a disadvantage at all in a Tomlin versus Arrieta matchup. I mean, Arrieta is their number two. You're behind John Lester, the ace who won last night. And guess what? Josh Tomlin is now our number two with the absence of Carrasco and Salazar healthy. But he has been so lights out in this postseason. He does not seem to be what's the word I'm looking for? He doesn't seem to be lost in the moment. He doesn't seem to be intimidated by the moment before him. I feel like Josh Tomlin is the perfect guy to close this thing out tomorrow.
Yeah, here I am talking about too much talk about the Cubs, and I don't talk about Tomlin. You're right. He is absolutely deserving, you know, to go toe-to-toe, head-to-head with Arrieta. He's been tremendous for the Cleveland Indians since his August swoon, where it looked like he might not even, you know, be in their plans for an AL Central stretch drive in September, let alone a postseason. And now here he is, you know, pitching game six at Cleveland after pitching well in his previous start against the Cubs, and then, you know, doing well in the postseason against Boston and Toronto. So Tomlin, he's such a gamer. He's gritty, he's gutty. He doesn't overpower. But you know what? I mean, Kyle Hendricks doesn't overpower either for the Cubs, all right? So just because you don't throw 99 doesn't mean you can't win and that you can't beat people. And Tomlin is has done so well with Roberto Perez, and they you know, Perez calls a really good game. Tomlin mixes and matches and moves the ball all over the place. If he stays out of the middle of the plate, he should be successful.
So what's your call? You know, are we going to a game seven? And you kind of came on sarcastically, tongue-in-cheek, making fun of the national guys. We're already jumping to it as if we don't need to play game six. You make the call now. Do we have a game seven in our future?
I want to sound like a hypocrite here, but I think it's going seven games. But here's the difference between me and the national media. The game needs to be played. Okay, I think game six will be a good game to watch. I think it'll be Boku ratings for Fox because there's not any competition really on that Tuesday night. I just think the Cubs will prevail because of Arrieta pitching really, really well. I think Tomlin has a good chance of pitching well, but Arrieta will probably be a little bit better. So I expect this to go seven games or predict it. But it wouldn't surprise me if the Indians win. That's, again, the difference in perspective that I have versus some other people. But wouldn't it be fitting, Bob, if this thing did go seven games? An epic, you talk about World Series ratings through the roof. I can't imagine a World Series rating that would be higher for this game seven, especially when there's nothing going on Wednesday night that I know of, right? There's no NFL.
I don't know, and I don't care. I don't know, and I don't care because it's not something I want to see. I lived through 2007 and the 3-1 lead over the Red Sox in the ALCS with Sabathia and Carmona going in 5-6 and then Westbrook in 7. I lived through that nightmare once. I don't want to go through that on game 7. I want it done tomorrow night, and that's the end of it for me anyway.
One more quick question from
our man Jim Cushlin here. Jimmy, go ahead.
You know, one thing I want to ask about is because this is yesterday was a Trevor Bauer outing. He was okay through the first three innings, and it all fell apart in the fourth. And honestly, I don't know if either of you picked up on this. I've been hearing random grumblings from all sorts of fans. It's almost 50-50 that, just get rid of him. He's done. You know, the heck with Bauer. What do you make of what Bauer's overall work in these playoffs does to his future in Cleveland?
Cush, he's going to be here for a while. All right. First of all, he's young. Second of all, he has talent. Third of all, he has he's controllable, or maybe not in this order that I've just listed him. But he's controllable for years. That kind of arm does not just fall off a tree. He will be an Indian for a while. Plus, if you try to deal him, you're not going to get dollar for dollar for him because the other team is going to say, well, why are you getting rid of a 20-something right-hander who throws 95 as a starting pitcher. So Bauer is going to be here. His performances in the postseason and even in September were uneven, to say the least. I think last night was a microcosm of it because he looked so dominant for three innings. I think if he could just have gotten through the fourth inning, Francona would have started to play the Andrew Miller game. He just wasn't able to. Some of the fourth inning was not necessarily bad pitching by Bauer. It was bad luck, a couple of, a bunt single, a swinging bunt single. So, overall, just a mixed bag. But, no, this is not the time to sit there and go, well, Bauer didn't deliver in Game 5 at Wrigley Field, therefore he needs to be run out of here.
All right, there you go. Dennis Manilov with his thoughts on games 1 through 5, and game number 6 is tomorrow night in Cleveland. I tell you what, D-Man, the last thing I'd say about this, I thought it was very kind of the Indians. They have not played a World Series game at Wrigley, as we know, in over 45 years, right? No, 71 years, beg your pardon. It was 45 since they've been in the series. But they had not played a game in Wrigley, so it was very nice of them to let the Chicago fans have a moment in the sun last night just so that they can come home and make sure to stink up their own clubhouse with champagne instead of doing it at Wrigley. So that's the way I see it. We celebrated from afar in June. The Cavaliers won the title all the way out in Oakland, California, 2,500 miles away. This one should be celebrated right there at Progressive Field with the fans right there in their yard. So I think it was very nice of the Indians to do that for their fans. D-Man.
I hear you, Bob France.
Great stuff, brother. Appreciate the breakdown. We'll talk to you after the World Championship.
See you, bud.
You got it. There you go. And there will be a world championship for those Cleveland Indians. All right, let me get a timeout now for Top of the Hour Sports Center. Got a lot of stuff to do in hour number two. Coming back to football as well right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Miller sets, fires, swing and a miss, struck him out on a slider. The pitch. Swing and a miss, got him with a slider. So Miller strikes out Bryant. Swing and a miss, chased the slider in the other batter's box. Andrew Miller strikes out the side. In the pitch, Coco Chris swings, lines one to right. Coming on, playing it on the bounce to Soler. It's a base hit. Coming home to score is Martinez. Throw to third by Soler, and Rajay Davis is thrown out at third. But the Indians have a 1-0 lead on the pinch hit. RBI single to right by Coco Chris. Allen with that deep breath comes set. Checks both runners. Now the 2-2. Swing and a miss! Ball game! He got him with a high heater! And the Indians have beaten the Chicago Cubs. 1-0 in a brilliant ball game here at Wrigley Field. Swung on, hit high and deep to right. Hayward's back on the track, looking up, it is gone, and we've got a tie game. Carlos Santana with his first World Series hit. Swung on a little dribbler, third base side. Charging Bryant, bare hand grab, throw on the run. It's not in time! Here comes the runner from third, Chisenhall to score. Ball got away from Rizzo at first. On his way to third is Naquin. And the Indians have a 2-1 lead. On a swinging bunt single, halfway down the third baseline by Corey Kluber. Swung on line shot, that'll be a base hit into center. Kipnis is going to be able to score from second. Lindor has delivered an RBI single to center, and it's 3-1 Indians. Win! And a miss. He went back in there and he got him on the curveball. Kluber with his third strikeout gets Ben Zobrist. Swung on, pounded, deep right field. It's got a chance. Gone! There's a game breaker. Jason Kipnis with a 3-run blast to right. And it's 7-1 Indians. Oh, what a night for the Chicago Kid. A swing and a grounder back to the mound. Otero gloves, throws to first. Ball game. And the Indians are 1-1 away from a World Series championship.
Everybody on their feet. The Cubs a strike away. Chapman, the 0-2 pitch, and a swing and a foul tip held by Contreras. And the World Series is headed back to Cleveland for Game 6.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, that is exactly what it is. Thanks for being with us right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo Sports Leader. Want to get you involved in the second hour of the program at 866-240-1065. Got a lot of stuff to talk about football-wise. That was a baseball World Series montage, obviously, as we get set for Game 6 tomorrow. If you do want to talk about Game 6, we can certainly do that. If you want to talk about the three games at Wrigley and how things went down, that is certainly on the table. No problem with that at all. But we do have a lot of other things to get into, including our Monday afternoon quarterback portion of the show. We started the show doing a lot about the results in the college game and in the professionals, but we spoke specifically about the Lions and the Browns games. I want to just get away from the local teams that we cover a little bit and talk about a couple of other issues, including the one involving Cam Newton again, more post-game controversy. And it's a bit of a different kind of controversy. But it certainly has people stirred up on both sides of the issue. And this is the issue. Cam Newton said yesterday, and you probably heard the audio by now, I don't have to replay it for you, but Cam Newton said yesterday in the postgame that he doesn't even feel safe on an NFL field anymore. He doesn't feel safe anymore. He's complaining that he is taking too many hits that he thinks are illegal. He's complaining that he's taking too many hits that he thinks are headshots, that are dirty hits. And that the league has a different standard for him than they do for other NFL quarterbacks. Now, is there any proof of this at all? No, there really isn't. There is no proof whatsoever of this, but there doesn't have to be proof. When you are the reigning NFL MVP and you are making allegations that you're being treated differently, it's going to come out a lot of headlines and it's going to create a lot of discussion. And that discussion is going to go all the way up to NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. You can be sure of that. As a matter of fact, that's one of the things Cam Newton said yesterday that he was going to do. He's going to go right to the commissioner to talk about his health and how he doesn't feel safe on an NFL field anymore.
I don't know, but too. I don't know. It's not fun. It's not fun. It's really taking the fun out of the game for me. Honestly. It really is. Because at times, I don't even feel safe. Right? And enough is enough. You know, I plan on talking to Commissioner Goodell about this. But it's not fun. And I don't know what I have to do. I mean, I showed a lot of frustration today, and I apologize to the referee, you know, who I was talking to. But I don't think it's a person that can go through what I go through and still keep that head.
All right, I'll stop it there. And by the way, you know, it's 2016. We've put a man on the moon. We've created the internet, instant communication. We have digital music. How come we can't find cameras that don't make that loud freaking clicking shutter sound so that we can hear an interview? I mean, I'm not kidding. All of us cameramen, did you hear the...
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You can't even
How could you
guy.
Not hear it?
You can't even hear the guy. I mean, geez, oh, criminy. We can't make a silent-sounding camera for crying out loud that isn't on a smartphone? God blast it, that's annoying. Anyway, if you were able to hear, or if you weren't able to hear Cam Newton over the sound of the clicking shutters... He said, it's not fun. He said he is going to go to the commissioner. He's going to go to Roger Goodell. He said he feels like he's not even safe anymore on the field. And now instantly, there are a whole bunch of other people, including Mike Greenberg this morning on Mike and Mike in the Morning, coming to Cam Newton's defense and saying, absolutely right, because at question, by the way, we're in question. There was a hit in the game yesterday, a win for the Panthers, only their second of the season, by the way, for the defending NFC champions. A win over the Cardinals. There was a play in the red zone. It was around the 20-yard line, I guess. Cam Newton was throwing from the pocket, and a blitzing backer came in and tried to dive and get Cam Newton before he could release the pass. And he dove low. He dove low. Now, he dove low from the front, but as Newton turned, he ended up hitting Cam Newton in the back of the knees. And that is clearly illegal. You're not allowed to hit somebody in the back of the knees. But it's also pretty clear, if you watch that play, that he was not hit intentionally in the back of the knees. He turned his body as he tried to make a throw, so he got hit in the back of the legs. Is that something that's a problem? Yeah. Can that injure somebody? Yeah. Is it something that was intentional? No, it was not, which is, of course, a big part of the issue here with respect to Cam Newton. Cam Newton, if you remember in the season opener, was hit, I believe, illegally a number of times against the Denver Broncos in the rematch of the Super Bowl. And a lot of people said, oh, my God, why is the league not protecting the MVP? And not just because he's the MVP, but why are they not protecting the quarterback, which is, of course, an extraordinarily important part of the game and their increases in safety? How can Cam Newton take that many headshots, some of which may have looked deliberate, some of which may have looked like they were, you know, at least questionable in terms of intent, you know, like they were going for his head? But there weren't any flags thrown in that game. Now, after the fact, I think somebody did get fined for a helmet-to-helmet, but it didn't affect the game because the game was already over and nobody was protecting him at the moment. Since that time, there haven't really been any episodes of egregious hits that were out of bounds. And when I say out of bounds, I don't mean literally on the field, but I mean in terms of, you know, the intent of the rules and that sort of thing. There hasn't been any issues. He did go into the concussion protocol for taking a headshot that was of his own creation on the goal line 2 weeks ago when he tried to hot dog walk his way into the end zone on an extra point conversion and didn't see a linebacker coming from the other side who blasted him and knocked him backwards about 2 yards before he staggered forward and broke the plane to complete the conversion. But that was on him. And it wasn't an intentional helmet to helmet. It was somebody coming up to lay the wood, and he went a little high. And of course, Newton, like I said, went into the concussion protocol. But now he's suddenly making it, and that was it. There was game one, and then there was yesterday's hit to the back of the knees, which was not an intentional hit to the back of the knees. But suddenly there's the question of, is Cam Newton being unfairly targeted and not being treated fairly by the officials compared to other quarterbacks? And again, like I said, Greeny was just vociferous in his support of Newton and his position on this yesterday. Golic was much more reserved, saying, yeah, this was a bad call. They missed a call on the hit to the back of the knees. But where is this coming from that this is happening all the time? It's not happening all the time. Newton said, it's taking the fun out of the game for me because I don't really feel safe, as if this is a weekly thing. And I'll say two things about that. Number one, Cam Newton is kind of the LeBron James of the National Football League in this regard. LeBron James at 6'8 and 250 of rock solid muscle, we all know this, goes to the rack and has people hanging off of his arms and bodying him, but it doesn't deter him because he's so much bigger and stronger, and he doesn't get those calls, and he goes to the rack and finishes anyway. And oftentimes, announcers, analysts, fans have noticed and said, hey, if that were any other small forward in the NBA, that's a foul, and he's at the line. And it's true, because if a 6'5", you know, 195-pound small forward gets hit like that, he's going to the deck. But if 6'8", 250 LeBron James, you know, a small forward like LeBron James does that, he doesn't go to the deck. He shrugs it off. That's Cam Newton. Cam Newton is 6'5", and about 250 pounds, and is solid as a tight end. And so when he gets hit, he doesn't feel it and doesn't show it as much as smaller, more frail quarterbacks would. So he's not going to get a lot of those calls, not because anybody's out to get him, but in this, it's just the same way as LeBron James. If it doesn't look bad, it's not going to get the call. The second thing is Cam Newton has a style of play that he needs to acknowledge and recognize. He gets outside the pocket and tries to make plays with his feet as much as anybody at that position. And when you get outside the pocket and you pull the ball down, and you might be a passer, but you might be a runner, you can indeed be a runner. And if you're a runner, you're going to take a lot harder hits than the average quarterback is going to take. And you're going to take more hits from a sheer volume of hits when you run the ball as much as a guy like Cam Newton does. So he's got to recognize his style of play is going to lead to a lot more hits. He's also got to recognize that he's a lot bigger and stronger. As far as the league isn't treating me fairly because of all of this, I would ask Cam Newton to go and look eye to eye, stand there and stare eye to eye with Ben Roethlisberger in Pittsburgh. And the reason I say eye to eye is they're almost the very same guy. Newton is far more athletic and faster. But when I say about the same guy, they're both about the same build. They're both about 6'5". I think Roethlisberger's around 240, 245. Newton's around 250. But they are both mountains among men when it comes to the quarterback position. And Ben Roethlisberger takes as many hard shots as Cam Newton does each and every week. It's why he misses two or three games a year on average. Because he stands in there and is a big, giant target. He takes shots just like Cam Newton does. Because it doesn't look like they affect him as much as it would affect a 6'2", 190-pound quarterback. Roethlisberger takes those hits and shakes them off, and then takes some more hits. And so does Cam Newton. He shakes them off, too. But Roethlisberger has never complained that he doesn't feel safe out there. It's just his style. He holds the ball longer, tries to extend plays, and as a result takes a lot of bigger hits, hits that might be called illegal on other smaller quarterbacks. But you don't hear Roethlisberger complaining. So, to me, and there's a lot of elements to all of this, but to me, Cam Newton, you know, has a right to complain if somebody takes a cheap shot at his head. He has a right to complain if the refs miss that. He even has a right to complain if somebody takes that shot at his legs or his knees the way that they just did. But, and this will be my final point on this, and we'll take a break, and I want to get your thoughts on this, too. Because there's a couple of other NFL stories I want to talk about outside of the Lions and the Browns. But the other part of this is this. What do people expect is going to happen in a league in which defenders are not allowed to hit quarterbacks up high? You're getting fined if you hit them in the head or neck area. You know they're going to end up going low. And now they're saying, by the way, you can't go low because that's where the knees are. What do you want? What do they want? What do they expect? When you tell guys they're going to get fined for hitting high, and then there's going to be a personal foul and a fine for hitting too low, you're essentially saying that defenders are allowed to do what? They're allowed to hit in the strike zone. You understand that? Picture a batter standing at the dish, strike zone, knees to letters. knees to letters. That's an average strike zone. They're going to tell football players moving a mile a minute, you can only hit in the strike zone, below the letters, below the chest, but above the knees. That's going to make it awfully difficult to tackle guys, especially big, strong guys like Cam Newton or Ben Roethlisberger. If you can't go down and get them low and you're not allowed to get them high and you have to hit them right in the middle of their torso, for crying out loud, you're going to make it awfully difficult for people to play this game on defense. The NFL needs to figure out what they want. And Cam Newton needs to figure out what he wants to do, too. I submit to you that the game isn't fun as much for him this year, not because he's taking hits, but because he's 2-5. His team is terrible. They screwed up. They let Josh Norton, Norman get away. Their defense is weak, and they're having a terrible season. I would submit to you that Cam Newton would have a lot more fun, and he wouldn't be complaining about these hits if they were 5-2 and on their way to another division championship and defending their NFC championship. Nobody was diving at the back of his legs. It was not intentional. It is one of these cases where what do you expect them to do? He's going to do whatever he can to get to you, and if he's not allowed to hit you high, and if he dives and ends up trying to wrap up your legs and grab you around the ankles, and you turn a little bit, and now he hits you in the back of the legs, yeah, you could have torn your ACL, which he said, but it wouldn't have been intentional, and it's not the way to address this issue. I heard a really, really interesting interview today with Moose Johnston, the former Dallas Cowboys fullback, talking about this, and he said, there are some issues, no doubt about it, but that isn't one of them, and maybe one of the other issues is Cam Newton needs to grow up a little bit and stop playing this game every time he doesn't have what he wants at a post-game press conference. We got to talk a little bit more about that. I want your thoughts. 866-240-1065. Do you think this kind of thing, by the way, is contributing to the ever-declining NFL ratings? Because the people are speaking out about what bothers them about the NFL and why they're not watching anymore. I wonder if this is one of those things. I also wonder if another lame NFL tie is one of the reasons as well. We'll get into that. Yesterday we had a tie, another one, the second in 2 weeks, and we had another overtime game, the prime time game. And I've got issues with both of those that I would love to discuss with you right after we take this time out on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
LifeLock.
When I listen to Audible, I'm not flying to my third sales meeting this month. I'm on a romantic date with my vampire boyfriend, Pierre. That pale skin, those dark, mysterious eyes, and those pointy teeth. Take me away, Pierre!
Ma'am?
I want to become queen of the night!
Ma'am, something to drink?
Water, please?
Go to audible.com/act now, and your first download is free. Audible, stories that surround you.
From painting to lawn maintenance, we protect our homes, both the inside and the outside. Now is the perfect time to protect the most valuable thing in your home. Protect your loved ones by practicing a fire escape plan and installing Kidde fire and security products. Kidde is here to help with a full line of easy-to-install fire and carbon monoxide alarms and security cameras. And you can find them all at the Home Depot. Stop in today for everything you need to protect your home. Kidde, technology that saves lives.
I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight. For my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
Be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Onward we roll. It is 4:35. Going to take you until 5 o'clock and some drive time with Mr. Miller. Mr. Miller, back this tonight.
Indeed, he'll be talking with Tim May, Columbus Dispatch, on the Buckeyes, and former Michigan center Jack Miller will be on hand as well, talking Michigan. So, a little World Series followed by some college football talk for Mike on drive time.
All right, very good. We're looking forward to that. And I want to get to the phones here in just a quick second here, but I want to share something with you before I do that, as I was referencing a few minutes ago about the ratings and why the ratings are falling as fast and as far as they are in the NFL. And everybody's got a theory, but one school actually went out and tried to get some real answers here, and it's Seton Hall University. They did a survey, Seton Hall Sports Poll, And I don't have the specifics as far as the sample size or number of people reached or any of the demographics or anything else. But basically, they're just asking, are you still watching the NFL? And if you are not watching as much as you did, why? And they tabulated the reasons why. And here are some of the reasons. Number one, topping the list, the national anthem protests. People don't like this. I'm one of them. People don't like it. I've said it from the beginning. If you want to take your social justice causes someplace, take them somewhere else. Do not disrespect the blood of the men and the women and the patriots who gave us this great country and your freedom to protest and to do these things. I don't like it. 56% of the respondents who say they are not watching anymore say that's why. The presidential campaign taking up too much time or much more of their attention, that's 50%. So that's the second highest reason why people aren't watching the NFL as much anymore. Number three, at 47%, domestic violence issues. People don't like having thugs on the football field. Josh Brown of the Giants finally booted by the Giants. Pardon the pun, he was the kicker. I didn't mean it that way. But obviously, Josh Brown finally cut by the New York Giants. We all know the Greg Hardy story. We all know the Ray Rice story. We all know too many of these things. But domestic violence issues have turned a lot of people off. Number four, with 44%, oversaturation. Too many games playing on too many nights. They already have Thursday nights. Now they have Sunday nights. They have Monday nights. And as you know, as we get around playoff time, there's Saturdays involved as well. Just too much NFL football, 44% say. 39% say, number five, Major League Baseball's postseason. They're distracted from the NFL because the playoffs are on. Okay. 33% say quality of play has decreased, and another 33% say head injuries and the concern over the health of the players. So those are some of the reasons why. If I were to pick any of those out to tie them to the story we're talking about right now with Cam Newton, I would say the latter two, the 233% at the bottom of the pile there. Quality of play, I think, has decreased in the National Football League. Head injuries, I think, have also been a problem. People are not letting their kids play football at the younger levels. This is a frequent topic on this program. I'm a youth football coach myself, so I rise up in defense of football at every chance I get. So I know I've talked about this, but people are not letting their kids play as much. And as a result, I think you have a lot fewer kids and parents who are watching the pros play it as much as well. That is probably at least, you know, partially responsible for this drop in ratings. And then you tie that into Cam Newton now, who is one of the most prolific players in the league. I mean, you don't get much more prolific than being the league MVP. He's an incredibly charming guy when he's not losing a game, by the way, like after the Super Bowl. We all went, I'm not going to relitigate that whole thing. You know, he was very, very rude and disrespectful of the whole process after the Super Bowl. But beyond that, I mean, he's got a smile that lights up a room. He's a great-looking kid, or guy. He's not a kid anymore, but he's a great-looking guy. He looks like he could be a model. He's got the nickname Superman, and he's built like him, for crying out loud. He's a tremendous player, reigning MVP. Makes little kids happy and gives them footballs every time he scores. Cam Newton is about as big as it gets. I mean, outside of maybe Tom Brady, I don't know, Aaron Rodgers, I don't know. Cam Newton's about as big as it gets in the National Football League. And if he is complaining that he is being unfairly targeted and not being protected by the referees the way other quarterbacks are, watch and see how quickly that number 33% there at the bottom rises to being one of the top reasons why people are turned off by the NFL. He is out there essentially telling fans, this game isn't safe. It's not safe for me, so maybe it's not safe for other people. His words, I don't feel safe out there anymore. That is not going to help this league. So the league is going to have to decide what they're doing. And they're going to have to decide one of two ways. They're going to have to say, yes, Cam, you're right. We need to do a better job of protecting you and all players and all quarterbacks. Or, which, by the way, I don't think will necessarily help the cause. Because if people are turned off by the game because of injuries to players and head injuries and so forth, you know, the NFL admitting that their superstar is right isn't going to help that cause. Their MVP, by the way, not just any superstar. Or B, they're going to have to distance themselves from that and say, no, Cam Newton is wrong. Cam is wrong. It is illegal to hit somebody in the back of the legs like that. In this particular case, yes, the referee missed it. He missed the call. He should have made that call. But it is not an admission that something is wrong here, that we're not protecting some quarterbacks as well as we protect other quarterbacks. It was simply a missed call, like we miss lots of calls on holding, pass interference, or whatever. It's a human error. It's the way things go. But we, of course, are committed to the safety of Cam Newton and all of our players. They need to distance from that. Because right now, Cam Newton is making it sound like he's going out there every game with a target on his chest. Or better yet, a target on his helmet. And that the league isn't doing anything to stop that. I think it's wrong. I think it's misinformation being advanced by Cam Newton. I think he's frustrated because his team is 2-5. I think he's not having the kind of year he had a year ago, obviously. He's missing some players. His team isn't as good. And I think he's lashing out a little bit. And I think it's going to hurt the league because it's just not true. It really is not true. Outside of game one, as I mentioned, game one against the Broncos, when he took some headshots that I think should have been flagged, and I said that on these very airwaves, they should have been flagged, the Broncos. Why would they not take care of the league MVP when head trauma is, you know, the number one issue that they're talking about? But over the course of the next several weeks, there hasn't been a recurrence of that. Nobody's taken any more cheap shots or headshots or anything else against Cam Newton any more than they are anyone else. Now, is he taking more shots, period, more hits? Yes. He takes a lot more than the average quarterback. So does Ben Roethlisberger. But that's a style of play issue, not a, hey, the league isn't protecting him kind of an issue. Being 6'5 and 250 and getting out of the pocket and running and extending plays, yeah, you're going to take a lot more shots than a guy who stands in the pocket, has 3.5 seconds to get rid of it, gets rid of it, and then isn't looking to take too many hits back there. That's a style of play thing. I think the league is going to have to do one of two things. Either agree with Cam Newton and say we promise to get better, or disagree with Cam Newton and say, no, we respect his opinion, but we're officiating the game right, and he is not under any more pressure or any more in any more danger than anybody else is. The league can't just let that go unchallenged, given the falling ratings of this league.
Hey Bob, right. With those falling ratings real quick, and I know we're going to get some of the calls.
I want to get to a call.
But I want to throw this out there, because of the list you ran off with the percentages of who's saying what the reason is, I found the most fascinating, because I could figure out arguments for all the other ones, except this one. And I find the answer to that one, I think it came in third on the list, correct me if I'm wrong on this, was the oversaturation one. I find that utterly fascinating, because we've all been under the assumption that you can't get enough football. You know, try to get them every day. Remember, we're now in the mode where Maxion's in action right now. So between college and the NFL, you'll have football 7 days a week. I found that answer fascinating. People would say oversaturation. I never would have thought that would have been the case with any kind of football, but there it is.
No, I don't find it. Well, I shouldn't say that. I'm not surprised by it at all, because I find myself in that. I don't say majority, but counted among that number, because there is too much football. What made football was like diamonds. That's why it rules this country in terms of the sporting landscape. What makes diamonds so valuable? Their scarcity.
Rarity.
Their scarcity. They're hard to come by. It's hard to get them. Cost a lot of money. That's what makes them so valuable. Football games were once a week. And back in the day, twice a week. College on Sunday, or Saturday, and the NFL on Sunday. That's it. That's what made football. Everybody can't wait till next week's games. You can't wait. That's the true value of football. But now the fact that it is on literally 7 days a week in some form or another makes it, you know, no longer as scarce and obviously no longer as valuable. And I think that's a big part.
I just keep coming to it, because I think that's the thing that, you know, if you're the league guys or even the college TV guys, stash that answer in the back of your head, because we've all been under, especially from that angle, well, you can't get enough football. Apparently you can.
Let's go to Steve in Woodville and see what he thinks about all this. Steve, you're on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, go right ahead, sir.
How's it going, Bob?
Good, Steve.
Hey, I caught something last night on ESPN where they were saying that there are 11 other quarterbacks in the league that have had more uncalled illegal hits than Cam Newton has, and I don't hear them crying about it.
Say that again. There's 11 other quarterbacks that what?
That had more uncalled illegal hits on them so far this year than Cam Newton has.
I did not see that stat, so I wouldn't be able to speak to that. That does contradict, by the way, what they were talking about this morning on Mike and Mike. And I don't remember, they were talking about the number of hits that he has taken compared to, and I don't know if they just randomly picked Drew Brees out, but I think, like, Newton over the last 2 years has taken about four times as many hits as Drew Brees has taken.
And, well, that goes back to style of play, like you said earlier.
I know. Hold on. Let me finish the stat, and then you can respond to it, Steve. I believe what Mike and Mike said this morning was he has taken about four times as many hits as Drew Brees, and yet only two of the hits that he has taken have been flagged as being personal fouls and unnecessary roughness on the quarterback, whereas 10 of the hits on Brees were flagged for that. So in one-fourth as many total hits, he got 10 personal foul calls did Drew Brees to protect him, compared to Newton, who had four times as many and only had two. I believe that was the stat. So what you just said to me about what you heard last night would contradict that to some degree. I just don't know which one is right.
Well, I mean, I think part of it is like you had said, it's his style of play for one thing, versus Drew Brees' style of play, because Drew Brees doesn't run as much as Cam Newton does.
Yeah, no doubt about it. No doubt about
it. And like
it.
You say,
and plus, Drew Brees is 6 feet tall, barely. And about 180 pounds, barely, and Cam is 6'5", and 250. You know, when you hit Drew Brees, especially if it's cheap hit, it's going to be obvious because this dude's going to crumple, whereas Cam can probably shake a lot of that off, and it doesn't look like such a bad hit. That's the LeBron factor I was mentioning.
Yeah, and I think all those points that you enumerated, I think you had some very good points. In fact, you stole a lot of my thunder. I was kind of hoping you'd stop talking and open up the phones.
Oh, man, that's my fault. I didn't know you were bringing thunder. If I'd have known you were bringing thunder, I wouldn't have stolen it, man. I'm sorry.
That's all right. It happens all the time anyway. I've been married 20 years. You know how it is.
You know what it's all about, then. Hey, Steve, thank you, my friend. I appreciate it. Let me bring Drew onto the radio. Drew is in Toledo. I hope I didn't steal his thunder. Drew, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was hoping maybe next week when somebody goes out, whoever Carolina plays next week, somebody will walk out and throw Cam a red jersey so we can baby him and coddle him, and he can be the only quarterback in the league that doesn't get touched. I can't stand him. Yeah, he's enigmatic, and he's got a lot of charisma. He's a awesome ambassador for the league. But, dude, that guy he whines when he loses. He's like that kid in high school that whined about playing time to his mom and dad. Mom and dad whined to the coach. You know, he's just a baby. He's a child. And, you know, you say he's a man, but he's a child. He whines when he loses. He whines because he's getting hit. Dude, if you don't want to get hit, don't take the millions of dollars to play football.
You know what he is to me? He's a little bit bipolar. Because, and I have to admit, I have a love-hate relationship with him. Because I used to say a lot of the exact same things that you just said, and I just couldn't stand this about him or that about him. But then I saw some of the wonderful things he was doing, and I thought, man, you know what? This dude is winning me over. I mean, he really is. He's being so kind and courteous to kids, and he's having fun.
Oh, and I love what he does for the kids. That's
I know, but that's my thing. And so I started getting behind him a little bit. Then he pulls the Super Bowl routine after the game in which he acts like just a spoiled brat. And then I hated him again. And then I started liking him. So I got this back and forth thing with him. And he does. He needs to kind of just grow up. I think Moose Johnston said it. He said he needs to get a little bit more mature and start handling himself.
Absolutely. I'd like to touch on one more thing on the radio.
Sure, go ahead.
I got an opportunity. All right, so the number one thing overall was the national anthem protest. Do you think that has anything to do, and I don't want to make this a social issue, but I think the majority of the people that watch football are blue-collar American workers, right?
I think that's a fair generalization, yeah.
Okay, so just generalize. And I think there's a lot of people that just are middle-class Americans that are so tired of this politically correct world that we live in, and I think that has a lot to do with why they're not watching the NFL. But thanks for taking my call, and I'm out.
You got it. I appreciate the call, Drew. Thanks. Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I think that's a very fair point. I played this the other day on the program. I don't know if it was Thursday or Friday, in advance of today, in advance of Halloween, obviously. And I don't know if I still have it or not, but essentially what it was, I think it's University of Florida, and I got to remember from last week, but I think it was University of Florida. They have counselors, psychological therapists and counselors who are going to be on hand to treat and deal with any college students that find themselves traumatized, offended by other people's Halloween costumes. They were literally going to have counselors on hand. And I did that story, and then I listened to the reaction, and people were just going ballistic because there's so, exactly what you just said. So much political correctness going on in this country. And I'm not going to turn this into a political show. I very, very rarely will cross over from my sports to my politics. But sometimes the two are crossing over because of what's going on in sports right now. But at any rate, there's so much political correctness. People are actually having to go and see therapists because they saw something that their eyes didn't like or they heard something that their ears couldn't handle. Really? Is that what we're doing? And you're right. People are rebelling against that stuff. And some of the stuff we're seeing in the National Football League does smack of political correctness. And people are, tuning it out. They don't like this crap that Kaepernick started. They don't like this stuff where people are. I mean, the one thing we all used to be able to get unified behind is what? Love of country. Might have a lot of differences among us. Might have differences among us politically, racially, ethnically, occupationally. So many different things that make us very different from one another, and the diversity is wonderful in this country. That's what makes us great. But we all come together behind our sports teams. I'll never forget the 1989 Major League movie in which the Indians won their division over the Yankees. And I remember in the bar, there was like a blue-collar dude like you're talking about wearing an Indians cap, cheering standing next to one of these like 1980s punk rockers who had like, you know, this blonde spiky hair kind of a thing. And
yeah, the mohawk. You sport the mohawk.
Was it a mohawk?
Oh, yeah. I remember the scene you're
You remember
talking
the
about.
Scene I'm talking about
oh,
right
yeah.
after the run, winning run score. Right
I know
after
what you, I know what you're about to reference.
Willie
yes.
Mays Hayes slides in with the winning run, right? And everybody's cheering at the bar and they're high-fiving each other. And then these two guys look at each other. And they look at each other like the guy in the baseball cap, the normal everyday baseball, you know, schmo, you know, Joe Sixpack, looks at this other freak. If they had seen each other in any other area of life, the one dude probably would have said, "You're a freaking loser," you know, because of his punk rock look, you know, that sort of thing. And the punk rocker probably would have said, "You know, you're whatever," you know, these, you know, in other words, square is the wrong word for them. You get my point, though. They would not have had anything in common at all. But their baseball team just won. So they looked at each other, paused, and said, "Ah," and they hugged each other because sports is the unifier that brings people who normally wouldn't be together together. And that's what we could all do is we could unify behind our teams and our country and our love of country. And what Kaepernick did was he started something that took that unity away. Self-segregation. I'm not going to do this. I'm not with you because I don't like that. And so other people said, "Yeah, I agree with that guy." And a whole bunch of other people said, "You guys are all idiots," blah, 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 and on. Now, it's like a civil war in a football stadium, in a basketball court, at a little league football fields, Pop Warner fields, all these sorts of things. People are just sick of it, sick of the political correctness that led to it, and they're speaking out by doing it the only way they can, turning off the TV, killing the ratings, and making the NFL address this. You'll notice you don't have any of this nonsense going on at the World Series, do you? You don't have any of this nonsense going on in the NBA, do you? Because the NBA's got rules. All the players have to make sure they stand at attention facing the flag. If you don't want to sing, fine. You don't want to put your hand on your heart, fine. But you will respect the flag and the country because unity is what the league is all about in that regard. And that is a very, very important memo that the National Football League missed. They didn't get that memo from the rest of the other sports. Baseball gets it. The NBA gets it, at least in that regard. I got a lot of other problems with the NBA in this front, but at least on that regard. And football is being hurt by it. I gave some other stats last week about this. And I can't remember the stat right now, but it was bigger than the 56% stat I just gave you from Seton Hall's survey, showing that 56% of the people think NFL ratings are declining because of the social protests being done by the likes of Kaepernick and beyond. But there was another stat that showed literally, I mean, millions of fans are turning away. Millions of fans are turning away, and it's going to cost the NFL in a big, big way before they finally address this. All right. I think I got to take a time out here and tell you about the outstanding college football national championship qualifier. We do this each and every day, and we're going to continue until the grand prize drawing. Give you an opportunity to go to Tampa, Florida on January 9th. You get a trip for two to Tampa, round-trip airfare, four-night hotel stay. Game's only one night. Huh, I guess you get the entire weekend all on us. Two upper-level tickets to the game, as well as a rental car with parking and a tour of the Yingling Brewery. If you love your brews, get it at Yingling in Tampa. That's a $5,000 prize package you could win. You could also win, if you lose that one, the runner-up prize is a trip to the Horseshoe, November 26th. Can you believe how fast that's coming, by the way? It's 4 weeks away. Michigan and Ohio State with limo service. And third place gets a prize package from Yingling. To qualify, be the fifth caller right now to 866-240-1065. 866-240-1065, or register online at 1065theticket.com. Good luck from Yingling Lager, York Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram, Country Heart Fireplaces and Stoves, Allegiant Air at Toledo Express Airport, Total Image Limousine, and Toledo's ESPN 1065 The Ticket. Next Friday, by the way, not this coming Friday, so you got 2 weeks roughly, a little less than 2 weeks. The 11th, November 11th, is the last day to qualify for that outstanding contest. So good luck to you from your friends here at The Ticket. All right, music is playing. You know what that means. Drive time is right around the corner. Mike Miller is back in the chair. We'll listen to Mike and have a good night. And then I'll talk to you tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.